I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
But Star Trek, the thing I've noticed that is very different in this era of Star Trek from the last era of Star Trek, you know, the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, really up till 2005 with Enterprise, is that there used to be a kind of the sense that all these shows were happening concurrently, you know, Enterprise excluded. That
right, right.
You could easily have Quark show up on this viewing screen of the USS Enterprise D and have Riker talk to Quark. I don't know why he answers the phone for the station, but you know, Armin Shimerman was available. Or you could have Data meet Dr. Bashir.
Listen, he was already in the makeup. They just needed to move him to another studio and read line for about a half an hour, and that's where they could fit it in.
Yeah, it's like Deep Space Nine appears in the first episode of Voyager.
Right.
Even though Voyager is on the other side of the galaxy.
It's on the lot next door, baby.
Yeah, but you can still have, you know, when they finally make contact with the Alpha Quadrant again, they're talking to Barclay. So there's a crossover with the things that are happening other there. All of these shows have a very easy time crossing over or referencing each other.
Right.
There's more of a need to say, okay, well, the Dominion War is happening now. So we kind of have to acknowledge that even in like some of the Picard movies, they reference the Dominion War, like the negotiations at the end. I think in Insurrection, they mentioned the Dominion War. You don't have to do that now, because to get a crossover like you had between Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks, you literally needed a time machine.
Right.
That there isn't a current era of Star Trek anymore, where we have these characters that are all in sort of the universal Star Trek present, that this is when shows take place. And if you're going to introduce something, you can introduce it all of them. So every one of these Star Trek shows takes place in a different era.
So that leads me to, I think, the most important question. Should there be?
I think...
Should there be a sort of a present? And I know having, like, basically, like, time travel crossovers between two shows is something.
But it also, the having to cross the barrier of time travel also makes it special, because you can't just have somebody show up. It has to become a thing that happens. You have to make it a big deal. So it limits it a little in ways.
Does Star Trek do better if it does have a present?
I think there's a strength in what we're getting now.
Hmm.
And it gives each one of these shows a greater degree of freedom to create its own little world and not have to conform to a house style.
Sure.
Like, Strange New Worlds happens maybe 10 years before Kirk and Spock on the Enterprise in the original series. So there's Captain Pike, and he's going on adventures, and he doesn't have to conform any of the thing they're doing to any other show. Lower Decks takes place, like, in a couple years after Nemesis.
Right.
And now Discovery happens in the 32nd century. And even Star Trek Prodigy was happening like at a different time post, you know, Nemesis. Like, there's a difference. I think it's later than Lower Decks. So there's all these different eras. So if you want to have your signature uniform, you can. You don't have to conform to anything. You can create, because you have your own little staked out section of the timeline that you can do whatever you want. If you want to have a war with, I don't know, the Breen, you can, and other shows don't need to acknowledge that there's a war between the Federation and the Breen.
Right.
And there's something kind of cool about that.
I can see that.
You don't have to worry about...
It's like big crossover events in comic books, right? Where you just to be like, oh, well, this story just has to take a break for one issue because DC is having some crossover event, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Get it out of your system.
Nothing has to interrupt anything. And I think that there's a greater appetite, especially with studios nowadays, to do that stuff. And it feels like Star Trek has made a deliberate choice to not do that. That now would be the time to really just cash in on crossover. And I think they were a little guilty of that at first. There's no reason for Michael Burnham to be related to Spock, you know?
Right.
He's already had one secret relative already, you know? He's already had one sibling. It just, Make it a different Vulcan scientist. Make the universe more expansive.
I mean, they've already said that the next Star Trek film that's going to come out, which is who knows when it'll actually come out, has basically drifted so far beyond the sort of Abrams verse Pine Quinto sort of triumvirate, right? That the next one is just going to be a Star Trek show, mm-hmm. a Star Trek movie. And to me, that would be even more fascinating if it'd be like, it'll be set in a time. It'll maybe recognizable, maybe not, but it won't be, there won't, Kirk and Spock won't be there. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm interested in that. I think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Give it as a vision for a filmmaker and some screenwriters. And then they can keep fucking around doing the TV shows in all these weird ways.
I think letting each show have a more distinct personality is a good thing. And then when you have those characters sort of intervene in each other's worlds, like you have like Boimler get shot back into the past, you get to see what the way a standard Star Trek cast responds to a guy like this when you're just like, stop talking about the future, please. And it's fun. It's fun also watching an animated character suddenly in live action. And that was just a neat little trick.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, ultimately, isn't that the main sort of joke, thrust of the joke for Lower Decks, is that these are Star Trek fanboys.
Exactly.
Essentially. Yep. These are people who grew up living in the shadow of these sort of legendary figures and having him meet Captain Pike. And this would be a big deal for him. But the idea that it's like not a captain that gets shot back in time, it's like an ensign, is kind of neat.
Yeah. Yeah. They're great characters. I think... Other than it being, it's not the Family Guy, the Star Trek Family Guy.
No,
I think that the first
even the Star Trek Family Guy turned out to not be the Star Trek Family Guy.
Right, exactly right.
Which was also refreshing.
It does have those funny asides and those jokes, and the characters are in a ridiculous. They're ridiculous characters for a Star Trek universe, right? The whole Cerritos is like so dysfunctional. The Cerritos as a ship is like the most dysfunctional ship in Star Trek, and the characters wouldn't react that way. But it doesn't matter because it's a parody more than it is anything else, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't feel it's firmly in the timeline of Star Trek, but it is firmly, I guess, just not canon. I think I don't think it even matters.
Yeah, it's but I mean, you can do little things like there's a clip of Boimler on Strange New Worlds, and he does a thing where he hoists himself up to a saddle and he goes Riker like that as he does it, which is swinging his leg over something, which is just a neat little thing. It's just fun. Also, Jonathan Frakes directed that episode, so he did that joke in front of...
I did not know that.
In front of Riker.
I did not know that.
But I think there's something kind of cool about that, and I think I have been very hesitant to want to see new Star Trek, but the more I've seen, particularly of those two shows, though I've heard the third season of Picard was a lot of fun, and the clips I've seen of it were very good.
Yeah, I'd say the third season of Picard... I read it described elsewhere by other more erudite people than me as like the Nemesis movie we never got, right? Mm-hmm. The send-off that we never got. I'd say it was absolutely, the nostalgia milking was at an insane level, was mm-hmm. at an incredibly insane level. And I thought that they stick the landing. I think that adding in the couple new characters... A couple of new characters are fine. It doesn't matter. I think the Jack Crusher character, I think, was really boring and not interesting. But it doesn't matter because he's not the central focus. The central focus is around the ensemble.
But I think
it works.
I think fan service is less offensive to me if it's part of a send-off.
Yeah.
Or if part of an anniversary show. And I mean, we talked about that before. The what is it called? Like the law of Luke Skywalker, whatever I was calling it before. I forget, what did I call that? The universal theory of Luke Skywalker, the unifying theory Skywalker.
Everyone's been in the room, right?
Yeah. Have you been in the room with Luke Skywalker? And I would say that...
If you're a stick of furniture that Luke Skywalker ever passed by.
Yeah. And I think that I almost have to, I don't know, amend that a little bit. And I almost want to forgive anniversary shows, because in Star Trek, what are the shows where people met Spock or whatever?
Right,
in a room with someone who had Spock. For both Voyager and Deep Space Nine, those were anniversary shows. And anniversary shows is where you do fan service.
Of course.
Because you're remembering the history of something. So, of course, you go back in time to Kirk's Enterprise, or you have a holodeck simulation where you see, you know, Captain Sulu on the Excelsior.
Right, right.
That is exactly the moment you do that. And it's also just a neat little touch like that. That stuff I am totally fine with. It's when it feels like every episode is an excuse to do a backdoor pilot and you forget, like, who are the main character of the show anymore? That's the stuff I don't...
Well, I honestly think that by and large, the course of what they've been doing says that they're not poisoned by this, by that. The first season, especially of Discovery, the first and second season of Discovery had that, where they're all this really, really terrible ideas that's like the spinoff, like having the Rainn Wilson, Harry Mudd show or whatever, like, because he was a part of one of the shorts that was on there, or having the Philippa Giorgio, is that what her name is? Philippa?
Philippa, yeah, I believe so.
Having her as the Section 31, like, as a Section 31 show, it seems like they've mostly dispensed with that, mm-hmm. and it's decided that they're not going to spin things off like that.
Well, it felt
and
like...
So that's fine, because neither of those would have interested me.
Yeah, I don't know. Discovery, from what I've seen from the outside, seems to be a show that radically reinvents itself every single season.
Right. And hey, if you can do it.
Yeah, yeah. That they just go, okay, that didn't really work. People might think this is a little dark, so let's go a little bit lighter, and then you inject, like, Anson Mount as Christopher Pike into the show, which... clearly, people have found it as a breath of fresh air.
Right.
And I think that the question of recasting, Anson Mount seems like the perfect rebuttal to a lot of people to say never recast people ever. I mean, you could also say that about, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi by Ewan McGregor, who is also very good.
That's true.
But, I mean, it's crazy to I don't want... How much worse would this stuff be if we just were, like, cut-pasting Jeffrey Hunter clips into these shows?
Right.
Because the truth is that Christopher Pike is a character who's gotten almost zero screen time in Star Trek canon.
And no character development.
Yeah, and because of that, I mean, he has an arc.
He's a guy who dies.
He has an arc in the cage where he kind of has to rediscover loving Starfleet and stuff, because he's pretty down in that episode. But for the most part, he doesn't get a lot of screen time to flesh out who he is. And that's really, really kind of fertile ground for an actor who wants to sort of inhabit that character, because you're not bound by anything. Nobody is going to accuse him of doing an impression of anybody, because Christopher Pike appeared in 2 episodes of Star Trek, technically 1.5 episodes of Star Trek.
Right, right.
Because he was also a guy in heavy makeup,
right,
in a beep chair. And
I love the beep chair.
And I look at that and I go, wow, this is cool, because it allows you to take a character that you haven't had anything with and actually give him a life. And I think Anson Mount has done a great job, because it also brought back this sort of optimism to Star Trek that is so fucking refreshing. It's so cool to sort of see that classic look to, like, that sort of 1960s vibe to people's haircuts and uniforms and things like that, obviously shot through a modern prism.
Right, right.
But it still has that sort of look where there's that sort of red accents and railings on the bridge of the Enterprise and all that. And it's really exciting to see that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously the Abrams movie also has sort of a love for that kind of...
Of course.
Sort of 1960s sci-fi.
And what they're pumping out now still has some of the DNA of the Abramsverse sort of thing in it, because producers, people who worked on those movies are still producers of the TV shows, you know, so there's the DNA that's in there. I wholeheartedly agree. It's the best thing to happen to Star Trek in a long time. And if we would talked about this like 4 years or 5 years ago, I would have been very down.
You were not happy.
I would have been very down on it. Yeah. Very down.
So I have been reading a lot of manga lately. Or trying a lot of manga.
Yeah.
I did not grow up with it. I think that there's a generational
divide. You're dipping your toe into manga. You've been into manga before, so
yeah.
You're just exploring now, right?
Yeah. I get a store discount, so I have a lot more of a chance to try things out than I would have before. And I have found stuff that doesn't do anything for me, too. I think I've kind of discovered that shonen battle manga just isn't for me, in terms of the pacing. tends to be. That's the shonen manga, of course, is manga that tends to be aimed at like 12 to 18 year old boys, generally speaking, and usually involves a teenage protagonist slowly growing and training and gaining skills and overcoming bigger and bigger obstacles while becoming more mature. That seems to be the overall theme of this from what I've read. And it also just happens way too fast. There's just one fight. It's like bam, 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 bam. Sometimes that works for me, but I kind of want it to slow down a little bit. Even something that has sort of relentless action like a John Wick movie still gives me like 20 minutes at the beginning for John Wick to be sad. It lets me lets me live in the world and want, you know, there's part of me I'll watch John Wick and kind of want to stay in that first 15 to 20 minutes. I'm like, you know, maybe this time I watch it, it'll be different. Maybe this will be a story about a guy and his puppy overcoming grief. And maybe Alfie Howland just won't show up this time. And maybe this will be a beautiful story.
So you've been dabbling, but mostly the shonen stuff, which I assume is shorter form.
Oh god, it's super long form. But
oh, it is super long.
It's very episodic.
Oh.
Like something
I expected,
say,
that you were talking about, like the monthlies where they, you know, where they have what, you know, a dozen or more stories running concurrently. But I guess you don't reprint those in America in the same way.
Oh,
they do.
Oh, do they do? Really? It's like the really popular ones, things like Naruto or One Piece or, you know, Dragon Ball Z. Those are all shonen manga. Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to. I know that there's gonna be a lot of people who have very strong opinions of all this stuff, and I'm gonna just go right off the bat and plead ignorance on a lot of it. And it doesn't really matter what your take is on manga. That
you're plead ignorance on the part of it being a bunch of filthy pervos.
No, there is that. That's in a different category.
Right.
But generally speaking, I am not super knowledgeable. This is a world that still, even though I've probably been reading at least a handful of, let's say, self-curated manga series.
Sure.
For a while now, generally speaking, I am not super knowledgeable about the medium.
Outside of
the little corners that I am very familiar with. Like shonen battle manga, I'm not sort of into. And then, you know, all of those ones where usually a young teenage protagonist overcoming bigger and bigger fights and stuff. I tend to find that stuff very repetitive, but I have the impression that I would probably like it a whole lot more if I had encountered it when I was 13.
Of course.
I had a bunch of built-in sort of nostalgia and like affection for it. But I don't. I'm approaching it as a 40-something-year-old man, and now I wish it would just slow down. it doesn't have to, you know, like if you do a storyline where...
These cuts are so fast, I can't pay attention to the
story. Because
sometimes
they'll have some really cool world-building ideas, but I wish they would just exist in it a little bit longer.
From what I know about your tastes, I mean, like 20th Century Boys. Like, yeah. Those are the kind of things that gravitate you as like big ideas, big worlds
and ideas, but also a level of sort of a personal attention that you get to live in the world, you exist in the world, you get to show me the world, you get to experience a regular day as these characters sometimes, that there is a downtime. And I think a lot of shonen manga tends to be very like, no, we're always doing the thing you came here to see. You came here to see the big fights and the big action.
Wait,
and the cool stuff.
So is it like watching, I was not a regular devotee of Dragon Ball Z, but I spent enough time in the break room at the auditorium that I worked at my work study job for college, enough watching other people's television to have seen my share of Dragon Ball Z, and the sort of the way in which they dole out plot and action is lots of plot, a fight, and then a little more plot. And like that's the structure, that's functionally the structure of it. Is it the same thing for the manga? Is there's like jibber jabber, jibber jabber, jibber jabber, fight, little bit of jibber jabber. And that is the arc of the
And I kind of want it not to be structured that way, just as a personal taste thing. The kind of manga I find myself getting into is the stuff that has been deemed seinen manga, which is usually aimed at 18 to 40 year olds. It's more
manga aimed higher than that?
I don't know. There's manga aimed at everything that I've really learned. There's kind of five general categories. I forget the one for like manga aimed at little kids. Mm-hmm. That's like Pokemon and stuff has stuff like that. There's even younger than that. I am not knowledgeable about that. There's also shoujo, which is usually aimed at young girls. And then josei, I believe, which is aimed at adult women. There's kind of the gender split. But the thing is, everyone likes a little bit of everything.
Right, right.
And I've heard there's even some Junji Ito stuff that is classified as Josei, but I don't... I wouldn't know. I just see it as Junji Ito stuff, you know?
I've been a guy who's been interested in Japan my entire life, Mike, and this is the first I'm hearing of this. So it tells you how into it I am, which is not at all.
So I'm probably expanding myself a little bit also because I suddenly have coworkers that are into manga, and I've never had coworkers that are into manga, and I get recommendations and stuff. But I'm also trying stuff based on the sort of buzz I see from people picking stuff up, seeing artwork that I like. There was one that I found really interesting in premise, but it really was missing something in execution called Chainsaw Man.
Sounds awesome.
So Chainsaw Man is a story of a guy who merges with his pet, Chainsaw Devil, who looks like a little puppy dog guy. They're both murdered, and they merge together in a dumpster. And now he looks like a normal guy, but he has like a ripcord that hangs out of his chest. And when he pulls it, his face and his hands transform into chainsaws, and he battles monsters. There's a lot of crazy things in the world building I really like, and I think the art is spectacular, but I wish it would slow down. I wish, because of the world building stuff that's hinted at in it, I really want to get more of that. Mm-hmm. I really want to find out what it is that they're building, but it's like, no, we got to chop people up with chainsaws. And it's weird, because you'd think I would be sort of all for that, but I'm like... the equivalent of that is a seinen manga would exist in the world more, and it would sort of build slowly towards things. Mm-hmm. Where no, they're like, no, we got to have a fight in the chapter. We got to build towards something. We got to have the middle. And I'm like, just slow down.
It's
not its fault because
it's a form factor idea, right?
Yeah.
Which is that some of them are meant to be published as part of monthly anthologies, right?
Well,
they're going to be 15 pages of a 300-page one, and they're going to be stacked next to others that are that way.
Yeah,
maybe it's like a half-an-hour sitcom. Like, the time and the format under which it falls will sort of necessitate the types of action that people will expect to be in that amount of space.
Exactly. They want to sort of keep people interested on a monthly or some manga, even weekly basis.
Like if you read Akira, for example, it doesn't fit into that at all, right?
No.
You could have 12 pages of Akira and then nothing happens.
Yeah, well, something happens, but it's much more atmospheric.
Right, right.
That there are times that you're just existing in the world. You're just on a motorcycle with Tetsuo.
Right.
And, you know, it's like you couldn't turn like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood into a shonen manga because there's only about three different fist fights that Cliff Booth gets into. If it was a shonen manga, Cliff Booth would be beating people up all the time. And he would get into bigger and bigger fights. And in the last one, you'd get into this like 7 foot tall Charles Manson that he would fight.
A Cliff Booth manga would be great, though. It would just be the day in the life of Cliff Booth.
But Cliff Booth is, it would be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is closer to a seinen manga, so we can have a moment where you spend, 15 pages just driving around Los Angeles listening to the radio with Cliff Booth, absorbing the world. Again, Akira is a seinen manga. 20th Century Boys is a seinen manga. I didn't even know what any of these words meant. And I'm still not entirely sure because I thought it was like, if it's aimed at kids, then obviously the really violent ones would not be shonen. But that does not to be the case because you can probably imagine Chainsaw Man is a very violent comic.
Yeah, yeah.
Chainsaws do things to human bodies. Did you know that? I'm sort of expanding... trying more and more things, and there's some good stuff. There's some really good stuff.
I'm happy, Mike. I'm happy you're back in a place where you're actually getting to discover these things.
There is
definitely a good side effect of your work, right?
There's a couple that I'm trying right now that are really, really good, but also extraordinary, harrowing reads.
Oh, wow!
There's one that I almost wonder if it would be something we could cover as a panel episode on the show.
Okay.
But I worry it would be too traumatizing and I don't, it's like, again, it's like a masterpiece that feels like sadness being and anxiety being poured onto your naked brain and you feel like the world could never be good again. But it's also one of the most artistically exciting and breathtaking things that I've ever read.
Wow.
It's a manga called by Shuzo Oshimi called Blood on the Tracks. I've shared some of the images and things from it on our Discord. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it is It is an emotional ride.
Wow.
When you go through it, it's incredibly atmospheric. There are incredible segments that show a subtlety and range of emotion that is oftentimes really, I would say, near traumatizing to read.
Wow.
Are done almost entirely visually. It has, in one segment of it, probably the most amazing, artistically, I would say, almost kind of, almost, I don't know how to say it, just not literalist. What is it when you do something that is very sort of strange and you have this sort of almost magical visual reality to it, to depict an emotional state? That you're not looking at something the way that like songs are in a musical.
Sure, sure, sure.
That you're not, that the reality, quote unquote, of the movie is these people aren't really singing, but they're showing me how they feel.
Right, right.
There's a lot of things. There's a moment with a panic attack, like a 10-page panic attack, which is one of the most harrowing things I've read in a while, because you can watch the art become looser and more unfocused and the backgrounds just fade and you just feel something that is just making this character's heart pound. You feel sweat in this comic.
I don't think I can read this much.
That's the thing I wonder.
It sounds like a real chore. I mean, it sounds like a real experience.
It's an experience, yeah. And it is... I think just it finished in its serialized format in the Seinen collection manga that it originally gets published in Japan. The collection is going to come out later this month. And now I just have to wait for these things to be translated.
Ah.
Have I talked about, I maybe talk about this a little sense to find out, but this is not a book that is for everybody, which is one of those things where I often wonder, because we do handpick our guests to find something we think they'd be appropriate for them and somebody they would enjoy it on some level or find some value or have something to say about it.
Unless it's a terrible Arnold movie, in which case it's punishment.
It's punishment for somebody.
Right.
It's a shit sandwich and someone's got to eat it. But the one common denominator for every single one of these things is you. And I wonder if I would feel guilty traumatizing you with potentially 17 volumes of this.
Woo!
For like a panel episode. And that's the thing.
Mike, if you deliver a volume of 17 books to my house, I'll read them. It's we're adults now. If you bother to do all that work for me, I'll do it.
Because it's a relatively quick read. It's very a lot of it, you will feel very bad about the world. And I also wonder how you would take this as a parent, because that's an issue of the book. Without getting into it too in depth, I think I can spoil one element because it's the inciting incident of the entire story.
Okay.
So it's about a young man named Seiichi Osabe, who is a 13-year-old boy living in Japan. And he has a very doting, overprotective mother. Named Seiko. And Seiko is somebody who, like, on his first day of school, sat in the back of the kindergarten classroom the entire time. He didn't learn to tie his shoes until later than other kids because she would do it for him. The sort of person who would cut his meat for him way longer than you should.
Right.
He doesn't have a lot of friends outside of, I guess, relatives. He's kind of isolated in a lot of ways, and he doesn't really see a lot wrong with it because this is the only life he's ever known, that his mother is always present. And then he and his cousin, who he spends a lot of time with, his cousin is a lot more, I wouldn't say he's a full-on bully, but he's very kind of overbearing, and he takes advantage of the fact that in a lot of ways, Seiichi has been very, I know there's a very loaded word, but I think it's appropriate, groomed to being very introverted, submissive, but also not wanting to do anything that might upset his mother or other people. And so his cousin comes over all the time and beats him at video games and like flicks him in the head and stuff. And he doesn't like it, but he knows that his mom wants to speak to his aunt. So he kind of puts up with it. And then they all go on a family trip, like a hike into the mountains. And they're all kind of walking up the mountain, and then him and his cousin are sort of near the edge of a cliff, and his cousin pretends like he's going to push him off the cliff and scares the shit out of him. His mother immediately grabs him and holds on to him like, oh my God, oh my God. And everyone starts laughing because they're like, oh my God, she's so overprotective. Oh, ha, ha, ha. Then later, him and his cousin kind of go off on their own, and his cousin's playing near the edge of a cliff and teasing him. Oh, come on, play over here. Oh, I'm going to fall off. Oh. And then suddenly Seiichi's mother is behind him and his cousin starts to actually fall, loses balance, and she runs out there and catches him before he falls. And then you don't see her face because you see this from Seiichi's point of view as if his mother catching her nephew. And then there's this look of brief fear on the cousin's face. And his mother pushes his cousin off the cliff. And the entire series is about the aftermath of this event.
Interesting.
She turns around and gives him this very serene smile and then makes a deliberate choice to start screaming for help, looking terrified. And now suddenly he has a shared lie with his mother that that is eating away at him, that he feels guilty and he doesn't realize all the way that she has sort of kind of set the ground, conditioned him in a lot of ways to go along with her, to be afraid of her, to be subservient to her, to lie to the cops for her because he doesn't know what else to do to protect his mom. I have to protect my mom. But then when the mom seems completely unbothered by what she did, he's the one who looks suspicious. He's the one who starts acting out in school. He's the one who's racked with guilt, who doesn't know how to talk to anybody.
Wow.
And the series is about what do you do when you realize that your parent is a psychopath? And that's the setting. That's a setting up of the entire series.
I like it. I like it. I like it as an idea. It doesn't specifically trigger stuff. I mean, I don't like child death, really. That's not quite appealing to me. I understand when it's used properly as a thing in fiction. But it sounds intriguing, Mike.
It is intriguing. One of the best things that I have read in years. I'm in love with this series, but I also know in very three times underlined, all caps, you know, 50-point font, this is not for everybody.
Right, of course.
It's a series that has very little direct violence in it, very little blood in it, but it rivals Junji Ito in how uncomfortable it generally makes me in terms of how deeply traumatizing and afraid of even quiet conversations it makes you.
That reminds me an awful lot of the feeling of Bo is Afraid, which is also a movie about experiencing someone's anxieties, constant, terrifying, paralyzing anxieties that are a result of his fucked up relationship with his overbearing mother.
It's a lot in common. So now imagine, what if Bo is Afraid wasn't funny?
Right. Yes. Because the first 45 minutes of that movie actually are quite funny.
It is. I love Bo is Afraid. Bo is Afraid is the funniest panic attack I've ever had, and I would love to do an episode on it at some point because it is. It's very much that kind of magical reality that it's all about matching an emotional state.
Right.
And how do you keep in this kind of plot operates on the sort of logic of panicked catastrophizing that whatever your worst fear that's going to happen in that moment, it happens. What do you think the motivation behind all of this? That's exactly what it is. Whatever you're afraid of, it doesn't matter. And it's, you know, the kind of fear that you have where it's like, I can't find my car keys. I can't find my car keys. Oh, shit. If I can't drive to work, I'm going to get fired. If I get fired, I'm going to be homeless. And you've gone from not finding your car keys to dying in a ditch somewhere. Bo is Afraid is basically like, let's play out one of those scenarios. There's a scenario with him literally losing his keys that turns into like, it's almost like the Dr. Seuss and That's How One Day on Mulberry Street, but it's with panic attack.
Oh, and it's so insanely kinetic too. Such a really intelligently done visual storytelling on that. But a fucked up relationship between mother and son.
Oh my God. And it gets more fucked up as it goes.
Yes, it absolutely does.
That movie is ruthless. Again, talk about movies again that are not for everybody.
And Ari Aster, we know from previous guests on our show, like, some people are going to like this kind of story, and some people aren't. You can be sure, like, a Sam Mulvey is not going to be watching an Ari Aster movie. It's just not going to happen.
There are a list of people that I know who are friends who I love, and they share a lot of taste in common with me, that I would never recommend certain movies to. Right. Because I know they would have a real bad time.
Certainly for Sam, he's basically has a almost blanket statement of, I don't want to watch any horror movies. And I can totally understand why.
He doesn't want to watch things that are just, like, drowning in somebody's misery.
Right.
That's actually part of it. It's one of the things that he had about not wanting to watch Post-Apocalypse for a long time.
Yeah.
It took him years to see Fury Road.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think he's in a better place now than he was when he first said that, and why he felt he was ready to watch it. But it's definitely something that I can empathize with. That if you're somebody with a view of the world that has a lot of things in common with how I view the world, the idea of thinking that the world is doomed is not fun.
And yeah, to have it being endlessly recycled and played out in media as if it's something we're willing to happen is we're willing in existence, I think, is also fucked up and stupid. I don't like it either. So yeah, I'm totally on board Sam's Sam's wavelength there. However, like sometimes I watch a fucked up horror movie and I'm like, oh my god, it made me feel frightened or scared or like disgusted in ways that I didn't know I could feel this.
Yeah.
And even though they're negative experiences, you're just like, but that was so fucking weird how they did it.
Like the end of Bo is Afraid feels like you were in a car accident. It is
right. But I mean, that's ruthless. That's the reason why I watch horror movies is that every so often a filmmaker will make you feel something in a way that be like, I didn't know I could fucking feel that afraid of that specific thing or disgusted by, or interested in that particular thing. Horror movies do have the way of being like they are very much want to have emotional triggers. They want to create emotional triggers as part of the narrative. And that's why I'll swallow like watching stuff that's, specifically unpleasant to watch.
I mean, it's interesting.
It doesn't fill you with hope, obviously.
No, I mean, it is about exploring those emotions, but in a safe way. It's like being on a roller coaster where I still get those feelings on roller coasters. There's always that sort of crossbar that you always look at your head's going to go thunk into. Those are the scariest thing. But I mean, we want to experience adrenaline. We want to experience fear, all of these things that primitive humans had to deal with on a daily basis to get food. But we want to do it in a way where we want to explore those emotions and why we feel those ways in a way where we're like in a movie theater that you're in a safe place. You're not in a place where you're going to get hurt. Whatever's happening on the screen that making you feel that can't actually get you.
Radio versus the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Pretty. Is that the type of girl you're attracted to?
I am so sorry for what your daddy passed down to you. But I wanted a child.
I'm visiting my mother tomorrow.
Do you ever wish that she was dead?
What?
Bo? Are you on your way?
I'm on my way. It's not safe, is it?
I sincerely doubt that.
I'm sure you'll do the right thing, sweetheart.